Law enforcement agencies in some states are preparing for potential civil unrest, maybe even violence, as a result of the leaked Supreme Court draft decision overturning Roe v. Wade. At the federal level, the Senate just passed a bill to give police protection to Supreme Court justices and their families. Over the weekend, an anti-abortion rights group's office in Madison was set on fire. In addition to the arson in Madison, there have been a couple acts of vandalism and attempted arson at other anti-abortion groups around the country. This comes after a long history of vandalism and violence targeting abortion providers, including a couple of mass shootings at clinics, a 2012 arson attack at an Appleton clinic, and a still unsolved arson attack at a Knoxville, Tennessee abortion provider last New Year's Eve. Our next guest is an expert on extremism and violence. He worries that our current political and social environment is a bunch of dry kindling waiting for a match. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this arson incident at an anti-abortion rights group's office in Madison? What do you think motivates people to commit acts of political violence? What do you want to know about extremist ideology? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Brian Levin is the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism and a professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino. Brian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we turn to some of the wider issues, Brian, this particular incident in Madison, you know, there's been an online claim of responsibility from a as yet unknown group. Things just look kind of vague. No arrests or charges filed as of our speaking here now. What do you make of this event coming in the aftermath of the leak of the Supreme Court document?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell the connections of who did this stuff. But we've seen this in other states, as you'd mentioned, including Texas, for instance. In this particular instance, the language used, the reference to Jane's Revenge, which was a collective that actually you have an article on your website about from decades ago, and the use of intermediaries and Bellingcat to get the message out signals to me that this is probably more than just a solo actor. And someone who is part of some kind, and it could be a very small and even informal association of individuals who are looking to this as an inflection point. And understandably so, Wisconsin and the nation as a whole has been both relying on this as precedent for decades and the majority, as I said, indicated by numerous polls, both in Wisconsin and nationally, do not want these kinds of restrictions on abortion.
Looking at a slightly longer view now, this has been a contentious issue since before Roe v. Wade was issued by the U.S. Supreme Court about 50 years ago. There has been violence, sometimes lethal, sometimes in the forms of vandalism and arson attacks. What have we seen over the last few decades when it comes to extremist violence and other acts related to the abortion debate?
Well, what we have seen from Eric Robert Rudolph's attack, for instance, in the mid-1990s, to attacks, a fatal one in Buffalo, New York as well. The group, the Army of God, which was this informal association. But here's the thing. What I think is so interesting is when generally, and I want to be careful here, but generally when there is a change in legal status of something that is very emotionally tied to people, whether it's what we've seen during COVID, for instance, or in this case, you will see people who feel when legal avenues are cut off that they will go extrajudicially. And since we're having such a sudden change, I worry about a couple of things. One, that this is a catalytic event. And one of the things our data has showed us is that spikes in intergroup conflict are lasting longer. There's more traction with it. And around conflictual election seasons where there are likely flips, we've also seen escalation in aggression and even violence. So what I think, though, what you can see here, look at what we've had in Wisconsin, for instance. During the social justice protests, we had the evolution of these civil guards. We now have this kind of thing that's been occurring for some time. Just bear with me. when we see an increase in conflictual rallies, conflictual public demonstrations, oftentimes one side will use some kind of aggression or even frequency as a way to rally the troops. So what I'm worried about is that when we see things like this, there will be a reverberative effect on the next group that would be the 2023 Proud Boys, whatever they may be, or the 2023 Oath Keepers. Particularly as we go into political seasons, some of the reverberations and side effects of legitimate issues of public debate and protest around it are those who will capitalize on it. And what I'm afraid is on the hard right side, we have people who want to be like shock troops to respond to any kind of aggression. And this is a kind of a first salvo that appears to be coming from the hard left.
Talking to Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism, professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino, looking at extremism, violence, and the abortion debate, and what might happen if Roe v. Wade is overturned. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What worries do you have? What do you think it'll take to keep an important debate civil from spilling over into forms of violence? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Christian is with us in Green Bay. Christian, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me. I think people being violent towards these things, it's to show, like, they're angry, and they really are angry, because this decision is going to have a major effect on their lives, and people use anger and violence, you know, to get what they want. And it has worked sometimes, and it's not the best method, but they do use it, and it's worked in cases. So I think people are going to continue to be violent. I don't think it's not good to be violent, but it does work, and it gives them, it showcases what they're doing.
Christian, thanks a lot for that call. A lot there. I want to start with Christian's concern that people may see violence as something that works to affect change on their behalf. Brian, what do we know about that?
Great question. First of all, Christian Science Monitor some years ago published some very interesting compilation of studies that showed that actually violence is less successful than nonviolence. But let me move on from that to the main point that your caller made, which I think was very interesting and an excellent one. And that is, in recent surveys, the new Roe era that we're in, we had a 20-year high in the number of Americans saying that violence was a legitimate way to resolve political disputes. But it was heavily tipped to the hard right, 30%, whereas on the left, it was 10%. Now that we've seen some inflection points, what I can tell you is I think that this kind of conflict will escalate. But again, I think a really good analog would be 2020, the social justice protests. The social justice protests were overwhelmingly nonviolent. Yes, there were some that weren't, but we also saw in June 2020, a record number of hate crimes against African Americans, and it seemed to correlate with this upsurge in social justice protests. So what I'm saying to you is, even when we have peaceful responses to visceral, highly charged events like the George Floyd lynching, or in this case, the Roe decision looking like it's going to be overturned, that will be an inflection point. And what we've seen with the data, whether it's aggression online or related type of hate crime, these spikes in intergroup tension and violence are getting more elongated. And we're also seeing them occur around political events. If we can just real briefly, if we can just look at a proxy, just using hate crime as a proxy, we've seen, for instance, the worst day in 2019 was around impeachment. The worst month last decade was November 2016, and the worst day in over a decade was the day after elections. So what I'm saying to you is what we have is a very amorphous type of associations where people will get quite genuinely affected. And most of these people will do peaceful things, but there will be those that are trying to exploit it. And these manipulators may not even be partisans. We've seen this kind of interference come from places like Russia and other countries over recent years. And unfortunately, social media has been the sticky swap meet where people can develop an a la carte type of position. And there are those who would want to exploit that. And what I'm afraid of is as the attention escalates, we already have an infrastructure on the far right that that is more likely to have firearms and to be organized in a certain way. Not saying that there may not be aggression on the hard left, but we have not seen a lot of it yet. What we've seen in Wisconsin and Texas, for instance, are a first salvo, and it might mean what we often see is when conflict escalates, it escalates on each side with one side predominating. And I think the predominant, we don't know yet. Let's put it that way. Let's see what happens. We're at an inflection point.
Thanks for the call, Christian. We're talking to Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism and professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino, talking about the political and social factors that lead to extremism in the wake of the arson targeting a Wisconsin anti-abortion rights organization. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about this, the potential for risk of violent extremism, or do you see things in our society that says, hey, maybe we can disagree and argue, but keep it peaceful along the way? What do you want to see from leaders across the political spectrum? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about extremism in the wake of the leaked draft decision that would overturn Roe v. Wade. Brian Levin stays with us, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism, professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your worries, your hopes at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Pat is with us in Eagle River. Pat, hi.
Yeah, I have a question. More or less a question. The Black Lives Matter group this past summer, had a protest all over the United States for various reasons. And almost every one of them didn't end, but had vandalism in them, where the stores were being ransacked, robbed, burnt, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage, vandalism. Who bears responsibility for that? I mean, is it the black people that bear responsibility for that, or is it the law enforcement agencies? Where does that come down?
Pat, thanks for the call. Brian, what do you think?
Well, first, let's get some facts straight. According with respect to insurance losses, well over $1 billion. In damage. However, Princeton University, ACLED group, they found that about just under 95% were peaceful. Also, let's look at some of the leadership. Al Sharpton, Ben Crump, and the families of people who were killed in police custody at the Get Your Knee Off Our Necks rally, each speaker decried violence, each speaker did not say that they were very resilient in saying that they did not regard reform as being anti-police. So if you actually listen to the leadership, that's what you get. But look, bottom line is, no matter what, June 2020, where we had a surge of mostly peaceful protests, according to Princeton University, over 94%, we also had the worst month for anti-black hate crime since FBI data collection had started. It was also the worst month for anti-white, going back to 92 around the Rodney King police verdicts. So unfortunately, one of the things that we have to understand when we look at this in a merely partisan lens is when we see heightened levels of conflict, people in their own echo chamber, and a sudden change or something that is catalytic, and in this case, it's both, I think we can expect a certain increase in conflictual behaviors. The question is, are we going to have an infrastructure of people who are either extremists or in an extremist network that will go even further? And in the past, what we've seen, for instance, when we saw stories of Antifa and BLM having busloads and plane loads going to various communities completely fabricated, we saw a response by self-styled militias. We saw, for instance, Proud Boys and Oath Keepers be involved in numerous conflictual public demonstrations and occupations in the run-up to the insurrection. So unfortunately, we have an infrastructure on one side and a highly charged catalytic event on the other, and we are quite concerned. We don't want to see anybody hurt. But if one thing I can tell you, what's happening in Wisconsin seems to me to be a job by someone who is more than just a dilettante. In other words, that they really have an ideological frame for this. And my guess is they're in some kind of network, even an informal and possibly small one. Remember, the Democratic Party itself, look at the Washington Post, did a story saying, please, protesters, keep it peaceful. Because what happens, I think, for those who are very concerned about what's going on, is that don't let the focus be on conflict. Let it be on the right that is deprived.
Pat, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Given, I hope, Brian, that all of us agree that we'd like to see less violence rather than more, are there proven things that, I don't know, political leaders can do and or say to help prevent that and to have people channel their energy into political means?
Yes, but first of all, it's a great point. We saw hate crimes against Muslims drop precipitously the day after and into the next year when President Bush talked about tolerance toward Muslims. Conversely, we saw hate crimes against Muslims go up when the Muslim ban proposal was presented. But here's the problem. We are so splintered and we are getting our information from so many places, and there is indeed a division industry. Look at what Tucker Carlson, the highest rated show in primetime cable news, is doing. So the problem is these printed circuits of stereotypes, which Dr. Williams from Cornell talked about, labels a constellation of people and groups as legitimate targets for aggression. And what I'm afraid of, conflictual political environment, when we have people who are manipulating this and aggression seems to be paying off politically, that has a reverberative effect. As I always like to say, extremism is a carnival mirror reflection of conflicts and debates that are going on in the mainstream. But what if that glass is cracked too? So yes, certainly civic leaders should speak out irrespective of what side they're on. But in an era that has foreign and domestic manipulation of social media, conspiracy theories, and systems that are set up where people are on different strata that eventually become funnels that can take people when they are highly charged and have them believe things and do behaviors that they wouldn't otherwise do, represents to me a time of both political, economic, and sociocultural stress that we're just going to have more people who will not only rub elbows, but will go down that funnel. And that's what I'm concerned about. We have infrastructures on both sides that can escalate things. But of course, what I'm very concerned about, on the one hand, what we've seen so far has not been directed against violence against people. On the Army of God and these other folks who were traditionally involved in going after abortion providers, they have crossed the transom. So what I'm saying is we have one side that has a systemic use of, for instance, violence and even militia-type organizing. Another side that now has just started, if this is genuine, using violence, but it's directed against property. The bottom line is, as opposed to casting blame, I'll just close with this. Violence, once that comes out of the toothpaste tube, does not go back in. And what I'm concerned about is folks like the Civil Guard, we saw what happened in Kenosha, will take already existing conflictual events and escalate them while being armed. And we will also have enough fodder for memes and others to exploit any side all over the virtual world.
We just have a few moments left. A caller on the line, Brian, asking if this event in Madison should be considered domestic terrorism.
Yes.
Easy. All right.
It's not an opinion. Hold on. I'm going to get all kinds of mail on this. When you use violence, threat, or intimidation, particularly with the commission of a crime like arson, that is meant to influence a subgroup, that comes under the definition of domestic terrorism. It's not my definition. What you have to do is, let's pretend we don't know what that office did, but it was firearm for ideological reasons. That, you know, that comes under the definition of terrorism. There's an ideological component, there's criminal violence, and it's directed to intimidate a subgroup. That's what the vandalism itself said. You're not safe.
Brian, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism and professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino. We talked about factors that contribute to violent extremism, including what might happen in the aftermath of this draft ruling on Roe v. Wade. You can always weigh in with your thoughts and follow the latest news on the Ideas Network Facebook page.